Antipsychotics have some serious long-term side effects. It makes me downright uncomfortable just to read them. On the other hand, it's reassuring to know that they are FDA approved for long-term prevention in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Or is it? Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlite Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psych NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Last fall, we spoke with Nasser Gami about controversies in psychiatry. He raised a question that stirred something in our listeners about whether psychiatric medications are truly disease-modifying and should be used long-term.
To understand psychopharmacology, you have to make the distinction between symptomatic and disease-modifying drugs. Symptomatic drugs like Tylenol, they have a use, they need to bring the fever down. But you don't use them long term, you don't use them at high doses because they're not getting at anything that's the underlying cause. Disease modifying drugs are much fewer in number, but they're much more important. Statins to prevent cholesterol, penicillin for infections. You use them maybe perhaps longer term in the case of things like statins, and perhaps at higher doses if you need to. And you don't care about short term symptomatic benefit. We have to make those distinctions, and in psychiatry, we're not making those distinctions.
We got a lot of letters for and against this view, and regardless of which side you are on, we are all in the boat of using medications long-term.
Part of the reason this is so controversial is that we just don't have much research to guide us on long-term use. Dr. Gami highlighted that disparity in acute versus maintenance studies with antidepressants.
If you just compare the number of studies we have and then what they found, for acute depressive episodes with standard antidepressants, this recent meta-analysis that got a lot of attention out of The Lancet, I think, identified 521 studies, published and unpublished. And in terms of maintenance prevention studies, in the FDA database, which includes all the studies that have been sent to the US FDA, published or unpublished, there's only 15 studies.
He went on to suggest that the preventative studies registered with the FDA are not as informative as we'd like to think.
Those maintenance prevention trials all have a certain design. It's called a randomized discontinuation design, where everybody has to be treated with their drug and shown to be effective acutely before they can stay into the maintenance phase and then stay on the drug or come off and go on placebo. And essentially what happens is that there's a worsening in the placebo, and that gets interpreted as efficacy of the antidepressant, where it's actually not. For maintenance treatment with antipsychotics and bipolar illness, it's the same story, same kind of design, same kind of misinterpretation. Interestingly, the FDA has no problem with it and continually gives indications using this design and even requests this design.
Dr. Gami's argument might seem a bit abstract for everyday practice, and this podcast might get a little dense as we explain it, but bear with us. At the end of it, you'll have a better idea of when to take people off psych meds.
But first, some lingo. Randomized discontinuation trials. This is when patients are started on a medication like aripiprazole, Abilify. The ones who respond are then randomized to either stay on the med or switch to a placebo, and followed for a year or more to test if the drug is helpful to stay on long term. Relapse versus recurrence. Okay, so this one sounds like splitting hairs, but bear with me, it really matters, especially when talking about mood disorders. Relapse means that the same episode came up again. Recurrence means that a new episode came on. So how do we know the difference? In mood disorders, an episode lasts for about 2 to 6 months. So if the patient gets better on sertraline and then you stop it after 2 months and the depression quickly returns, it's a relapse of the same episode. If, however, you stop that sertraline and the depression comes back a year later, it's a recurrence. Part of the idea behind relapse is recognizing that patients are in a vulnerable time in the months just after recovering from an episode. The forces that caused that episode, whether biological or psychosocial, are still at play.
Dr. Gami's point is that these discontinuation trials have two main flaws. One, they stop the medication too soon. Instead of waiting 6 to 12 months to get fully into the maintenance phase, they stop the medication after 2 to 3 months. This doesn't prove that the medication works or is necessary long term. It just proves that you shouldn't take it away when the patient is just starting to recover and is still technically in the episode. Part of his proof for this is that nearly all of the relapses that occur in these studies happen shortly after the drug is discontinued. So we'd classify those as relapses, not recurrences. And even though those studies went on for 12 months or more, they were only able to prove that continuing the drug prevented relapses of the original episode in the early phase, the first few months, not recurrence of new ones much later.
So relapse and recurrence really do matter. So Dr. Haken, what's the other flaw?
These discontinuation trials also have what's called an enriched design. Before they discontinue the medication, they first trim down their sample to just the ones who responded to it. Usually that means cutting out about half of the patients from the study. What this does is inflate the numbers for the drug. It makes it look a lot more effective than it is. If they included all patients who started out on the drug, we wouldn't see nearly as many relapses when the drug is taken away.
There's another point some of our listeners brought up. What about a physiologic withdrawal effect, like what we see with SSRIs and benzodiazepines? What if the drug was simply stopped too quickly and the relapses were just a withdrawal effect?
That problem is also in the mix. I asked Dr. Gammy about it tonight, and he believes that the first two points are the main problems, but that a withdrawal effect is also possible here.
Well, I want to harp on this a little bit more, because many of our listeners are concerned about drug withdrawal, and some even brought up that lithium has a withdrawal effect, which is one of the meds that Dr. Gammy favors for long-term prevention. When lithium is stopped abruptly, the risk of mania, depression, and suicide peaks. It's one drug that needs to be tapered gradually, like over 1 to 3 months at least, instead of 1 to 3 weeks.
That's true for lithium. And a few of the early studies in the 1970s were tainted by that withdrawal effect. Back then, they didn't know as much about this problem, and they took away the lithium too quickly. But most of the lithium studies, and in fact, many of the antidepressant and antipsychotic studies, took care not to withdraw the med too quickly.
And how quickly is quickly?
For most psychiatric meds, too quickly means 2 to 3 weeks or less. Tapering off faster than 2 to 3 weeks just about doubles the risk of relapse. That's been shown in schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, and panic disorder. So when a patient calls you and wants to come off their med, you can double their chance of success by guiding them to do it over 2 to 3 months instead of 2 to 3 weeks.
Back to the discontinuation studies. The FDA has approved a lot of meds for long-term use based on these trials. Olanzapine, aripiprazole, quetiapine, venlafaxine, paroxetine, and fluoxetine. Is Dr. Gammy saying we shouldn't use these long-term?
He's just saying we don't know.
What we need to see is that patients get better on the antidepressant without getting withdrawn, just getting randomized to one versus nothing, placebo, without pre-selecting for efficacy to begin with for acute symptoms, and following them for at least a year or longer, and showing that you prevent episodes. In fact, almost no studies are designed that way, and very few find any benefit in that direction. So it's not that they're disproven for long-term efficacy. My contention would be they're actually just not proven because we aren't doing the kinds of studies we need to do.
Well, even if those studies are flawed, they do tell us one thing. Don't stop antidepressants or antipsychotics when the patient has only been in recovery for 2 to 3 months. That's too soon, and you're likely to see a relapse. But how long should you continue them for?
We don't know, because they aren't doing those types of studies. Now, you did say antipsychotics, Kelly, and let me clarify, this podcast is about mood disorders. If we're talking about schizophrenia, the weight of the evidence favors long-term maintenance with antipsychotics to prevent schizophrenia.
Well, why don't they have those studies in mood disorders?
Because it's too expensive, and it might not be possible to do. It's very hard to keep patients in a study that long. To do what Dr. Gammy is suggesting, you'd need to keep the patients in the trial and keep them well for at least 6 months before randomizing them. The dropout rates would be very high. In some of these studies that have attempted to look at the long-term picture, the dropout rate has been 100%. That's just not going to get you anywhere. despite all this lack of data, we did publish an article this month on when to discontinue antipsychotics in mood disorders. Part of the inspiration for the article was that we were researching tardive dyskinesia and finding a surprisingly high rate of 2.6% per year of tardive dyskinesia on atypical antipsychotics. That does seem surprisingly high, and what's probably going on there is the cases are not as severe as you might expect, so they're subtle and mild. In the report, we did find one randomized discontinuation study that tested whether antipsychotics could be safely discontinued after 6 months, and the result was that it could when they were used as adjunctive therapy for bipolar mania. So in other words, they kept those patients on their mood stabilizer, lithium or Depakote, long term, but the study showed that relapse rates were much lower if it was discontinued after 6 months, while discontinuation after 1 to 2 months led to, as we would expect, high rates of relapse. The details are all in the report.
Another thing about that study is that it was funded by the Canadian version of the National Institutes of Health. The other studies, the yank it away ones, were sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry. Now let's go back to those FDA maintenance studies. I'm a little confused about this critique that the studies are enriched with patients who responded to the med. I mean, that's actually more true to what I see in practice. I follow up with someone after starting quetiapine, and they're better. And I'm wondering whether to keep them on it or not. I wouldn't be asking that question if they didn't respond to it.
That's true. And from that point of view, the studies do tell you something. Like I said earlier, they tell you not to stop the drug after just 2 to 3 months. What Dr. Gammy is getting at here points to a deeper problem in our field. These studies, with their flawed designs, are robbing us of the ability to tell which medications are truly preventative. Instead, we're left assuming that what works in the short term will also work in the long term. And Gammy's argument is that, at least with antidepressants and antipsychotics and mood disorders, that is a leap of faith. He calls this the happily ever after fallacy.
Happily ever after fallacy, the idea that what gets you better keeps you better. That perspective doesn't take into account that there's differences between short-term and long-term effect. And sometimes drugs are effective symptomatically acutely, but they have no long-term benefit because they don't modify the underlying disease. Classic example is Tylenol for fever. And then you have the reverse scenario where a drug affects the underlying disease but has no short-term symptomatic benefit at all. Classic example is penicillin for infections that cause fever.
I can see where this idea applies in bipolar. I mean, we're always treating new episodes, but in the background, I'm really trying to find a med that will help them long-term. And patients don't always appreciate that, as they don't want to think about being on a medication long-term. But as we talk about this, I'm imagining a very insightful person with bipolar coming to see me and saying, "Kelly, I've been on lots of meds that just wear off, and I've come to realize I have a lifelong mood problem, and I'm going to need something that will work long term. What do you got?" So what would I tell them?
That is the heart of it. Dr. Gammy is saying we don't have good answers for that question. He does suggest that lithium and the anticonvulsants have better evidence that way for long-term prevention. We won't have time to get into all of that data in this podcast, but it's well covered in Dr. Gammy's book on psychopharmacology that came out this year. For example, with lithium, it has been shown to have preventative benefits in studies that were not enriched to favor lithium. And in the long-term lamotrigine lithium trials, the ones that lasted a year and a half and led to lamotrigine's approval for maintenance, the preventative effects did not cluster around the first few months after discontinuation. In other words, those two medications had preventative effects not just for relapses of the current episode, but for recurrence of new episodes. There's also a lot of naturalistic data that illustrates the benefits of lithium. These studies are not controlled, but they do have the benefit of going on for many years. A study published last year followed children and adolescents with bipolar disorder for 10 years on various medications. Only the children on lithium did significantly better at the end. They had half as many suicide attempts, better functioning, and less depression and aggression. Another large study followed adults with bipolar disorder for 2 to 3 years, and they compared how people did on valproate, Depakote, carbamazepine, that's Equitro, or lithium. The ones on lithium stayed well about twice as long.
Clinical interpretation of disease modification, in my view, is that you're not just treating the current acute symptoms of a disease, but that you're preventing the symptoms of the disease in the future and or preventing progression of the disease. In other words, you're changing the morbidity and the mortality of the disease long-term, not just current symptoms. In the case of psychiatry, the only drug that has long-term reduction in morbidity and mortality is lithium. It reduces death by suicide and by medical illnesses, and it reduces hospitalization rates, etc. Maybe to some extent we have some data on some other mood stabilizers to that effect long-term, but that's what would prove disease modification.
Okay, so let's recap. When you're choosing a medication for bipolar, look for one that can keep them well long-term and one that's tolerable enough to take long-term. The antipsychotics may not be the best choice there. Even if you don't agree with Dr. Gammy's critique of these studies, they do carry a risk of tardive dyskinesia, not to mention diabetes, high triglycerides, and weight gain. Even when you use the best prevention in bipolar disorder, patients are still going to come in with new episodes. And you may need to use an add-on med, like an atypical antipsychotic. But when you do, try to keep the patient on it for 6 months after they recover before you consider tapering off. And if you do taper off, do so slowly, like over 1 to 3 months.
I'd use the same guideline in unipolar depression, to wait at least 6 months before even thinking about coming off an antidepressant, and recognizing that some patients might need to be on that medication for the long term. Patients often want to stop their meds after recovery. From their point of view, if they've been well for 2 months, they're ready to go. The problem is that that's too short in brain time, and at 2 months out, they are still close to the forces that caused the original episode, whether those forces be psychosocial or biological, and that episode is likely to come back. What I try to do with patients is to channel their enthusiasm for getting off the med into an enthusiasm for building a lifestyle that can help them stay off the med. I tell them that I'm committed to helping them get off the medication if that's what they generally want to do, but that I'm really committed to helping them get off successfully. And that means building in things like aerobic exercise, Mediterranean diet, waking up at regular times, and regular sleep patterns, social supports and therapy, mindfulness, the list goes on. If it's bipolar disorder, keeping the bedroom really dark at night and having regular sleep patterns. Patients don't need to do all of those things, but I present it like a menu and let them choose some to build into their life, and that helps make medication discontinuation more successful.
Please visit us online at thecarlattreport.com, where you will find the full articles that we discuss. And for our podcast listeners, we always offer a special discount where you can get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST.
And that'll help us remain one of few CME publications that receives no funding from advertising or industry support.